Another edition of Pittsburgh Pop. Tim Benz and Rob Owen with you here at Trib Live. Rob, you can read him TV Talk, TV Q&A at Trib Live. You can check me out Monday through Friday, Breakfast with Benz, and the sports podcast page, which largely for the past couple of weeks and for the next few weeks will be training camp specific, brought to you by Bella Construction. Our Letters from Camp podcast continue. So this is our departure, my departure, as we do pop culture from around Pittsburgh and the television and film world. But Rob, let's start with the movies first and foremost. And Warner Brothers, HBO Max, getting rid of a nearly completed Batgirl. Why did they do that? What happened? This was kind of an intriguing story late last week.
You know, we've sort of seen in the first 6 months of this year that the straw house of streaming is starting to fall down for all of these media conglomerates. Netflix had a bad earnings earlier this year, and suddenly Wall Street said, whoa. We didn't mean we want subscriber growth. We want you to make money. All these companies that had gone all in on streaming were suddenly caught short because they were doing what Wall Street wanted and prioritizing subscriber growth and not revenue growth. And I think what you're seeing with HBO Max is a couple of things. First of all, the merger with Discovery, they took on a huge amount of debt, so they are under tremendous pressure to cut costs. They canceled CNN Plus right out of the gate, and now they are up against a wall because my understanding, and I am not a tax attorney, so don't hold me to this, but my understanding from what I have read is that they can take tax write-offs on things up to a certain point relating from the merger. So they have decided that they're not all in on streaming. They have one foot in streaming. They have one foot in theatrical releases. They are re-emphasizing theatrical releases. And Batgirl was a $90 million production, which, yeah, a lot of money, but compared to $185 million that they spent on the Batman, it did not have the same cinematic look. They want the DC universe to be, to look a certain way. And so they could have either put more money into Batgirl to get it up to snuff, or they could have just killed it and taken the tax write-off. And they chose to kill it and take the tax write-off. I'm disappointed because Michael Keaton is in it, reprising his role as Batman. So now we're never going to see that unless they backtrack at some point. He is also reprising his Batman character in The Flash, which is coming out as a theatrical release next year. So we'll get to see it, just not as much of it. So they killed that. They also killed a Scooby-Doo animated movie. And they've been killing shows on TBS and Turner. They canceled Chad. They canceled The Last OG. Those are owned by Warner Brothers. They're basically done with scripted series on Turner and TBS. Now, Batgirl got bad scores in test screenings, but that's not unusual. It wasn't complete. Was it really that bad that they couldn't release it? I sort of doubt it. I just think it wasn't as grandiose as they would want it to be for theatrical release. And it was originally intended for HBO Max. They've decided they're not going to do expensive movies for HBO Max anymore. And they are combining HBO Max and Discovery Plus, but not until next summer. But it's a bad look for them, and certainly bad within the creative community, because if you're a director, why would you want to go to HBO Max or Warner Brothers if there's the chance that they could just, you know, turn your project into a tax write-off?
Is this the kind of thing, Rob, where because it was killed by HBO Max, somebody else can pick up the project, or because the DC world is linked to HBO Max copyright-wise, deals-wise, that's not allowed?
Yeah, I mean, one option could have been to sell the film to Netflix or something. But Warner Brothers Discovery owns DC. They own the rights. And I think the only way you get the tax write-off is if you deep six the thing. So they have decided that it is more to their financial benefit to take the tax write-off than to ever let this thing see the light.
On a side note to this, what do you think about Michael Keaton reprising the Batman role?
Oh, I'm super interested to see how that turns out. I mean, obviously, we're in some sort of weird metaverse thing. If his Batman is coming back, I don't know if any of the other Batmans are coming back for The Flash. But it's been a long time, and I'm very curious to see what he does with it. Clearly, his Batman slash Bruce Wayne has aged. And so what does that look like now? So that was why I was kind of excited for Batgirl, because I knew we were going to get some of him in The Flash, but then we were going to get more of him in Batgirl. So I'm disappointed about that. I did try to see if he had any comment about Batgirl getting shelved, but his publicist never responded to my inquiry.
Was he the best Batman, or was he just the first Batman so we remember him finally, especially here in Pittsburgh? I mean, I know we've got a tainted view because he's a Pittsburgh guy, but do you think he was the best Batman of the re-releases, like the 90s onwards? Was he the best one?
I certainly liked him better than Val Kilmer or George Clooney. But then when you compare him to Christian Bale, that's tough, because Christian Bale's Batman was quite good, too. And yet I will always have a soft spot in my heart for the Adam West Batman.
Of course.
So that may be my favorite Batman, to be honest.
Well, was Michael Keaton just better at being Bruce Wayne? And was that the difference?
Yeah, I sort of wonder if that's it, that his Bruce Wayne was a little, you know, he had that Michael Keaton energy, which you're not going to get from a Christian Bale Bruce Wayne.
All right, so let's get to some other things, Rob, throughout the course of the week, and there is a lot to get to. What about Prey, the new Predator movie on Hulu, since we're on a movie topic today so far?
Yeah, so this was made directly for Hulu, and it's a Predator prequel that goes back in time to the 1700s when a Predator comes to Earth and is fought off by a Native American woman. It's an interesting way in. It's not a time period we've seen the Predator in. I don't know that we've seen the Predator up against a woman before. So I thought all of those things were sort of fresh ways into the story. It is somewhat predictable, like you can kind of call who's going to die in this thing. You know that the bad guys are going to die. Any of the Native Americans who are being mean to the woman, or any of the French trappers who are threatening the Native Americans, you know that they're all dead, just because that's kind of formula. But the lead woman, I think her name is Amber Midthunder. She's very good in this. Looks a little bit like Aubrey Plaza in the eyes, which distracted me a little bit because I kept thinking she was going to say something funny to the Predator, and she never did. But she's quite good. There's also a guy who plays her brother, who I've never seen before, Dakota Beavers. And I thought for a made-for-Hulu movie, the special effects were pretty decent. I mean, they could be somewhat rudimentary because you're on the Great Plains in the 1700s. And it's 90 minutes. It's compact. It's economic. So, yeah, I thought if you like horror sci-fi movies with a little dose of some history thrown in on the side, I thought it was pretty good.
Now, is it the same Predator alien bad guy that we know from the movies?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And the heat mapping and all that.
The heat mapping, the click, click, click sounds, all of that. Yep. Same one, maybe slightly redesigned just because, you know, they always have to tinker. But by and large, yeah, exactly the same.
Well, the other thing that I wanted to bring up on Netflix was The Sandman. Can we get into that, too?
Yeah. So I did not review this one because I am not well versed in the Sandman world. I've not read the comic books by Neil Gaiman. This has been a project in the works for 30 years, and one of the stars is Mason Alexander Park, who went to Point Park University in Pittsburgh. Tom Sturridge plays Sandman, also known as Dream, also known as Morpheus. I watched a good chunk of the series, and I actually thought it held my attention better than a lot of fantasy shows have, but there is a fair bit of sort of build up and world building before you sort of get to the plot moving forward. So it's probably not something I would go out and watch on my own if I wasn't going to be talking to Mason for last week's column. But I thought relative to a lot of fantasy things we've seen, like The Wheel of Time, which was a big snooze to me, I thought The Sandman was better than average, at least.
How about the TCA Awards? Now, these were winners, right? Not nominations. These are actually awards that were handed out.
Correct. So the Television Critics Association, which I'm past president current member of, gave out its annual awards this weekend. We were supposed to do it in person. We were supposed to have an in-person press tour this summer. And then at the last minute, because of rising COVID BA5 cases in Los Angeles, it moved from in-person to virtual again. So I'm not in LA. I'm just watching press conferences on Zoom and asking questions that way. But the TCA Awards, which should have been handed out in a ceremony Saturday night, were instead sent out via press release. And the big winner was Abbott Elementary on ABC. It won, if I'm counting correctly here, I think it won 4 awards. Yeah, Program of the Year, Outstanding Achievement in Comedy, Outstanding New Program, and Outstanding Individual Achievement in Comedy for star Quinta Brunson. Glad to see Abbott Elementary get the attention. And Pittsburghers will be happy to know that Mandy Moore, who got snubbed by the Emmys for her This Is Us role, won for Individual Achievement in Drama.
And of course, her ties being with This Is Us, and that. Yes. So help me out with the timeline. This Is Us, their finale was what now, about 7 or 8 months ago, something like that?
Oh, not that long ago. It was in May.
Oh, it was in May. Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Time freezes sometimes for me when we're out of football season. I get in this weird sort of, I can't remember when things happened and when they didn't happen, this vortex. Speaking of which, we can probably mix in a little sports conversation here too, as it relates to TV and sort of pop culture, because, well, first and foremost, the Steelers will have their preseason opener without Ben Roethlisberger at quarterback. It'll be the first game that the Steelers play at the now Acrisure Stadium. I'm just going to keep saying it so people get used to hearing it. And I'm not going to, it's not my job to carry the Heinz flag for everybody. I'm sorry. I can't keep doing it. I have to call the stadium when it's called. So Acrisure Stadium will host the Steelers for their first game in the preseason against the Seahawks on Saturday. I'm real interested to see what the numbers are like, Rob, locally on KDKA. The Steelers always do a big number, but I'm wondering if you get the, well, Ben's not around, so we're not watching as much audience, or what is it going to look like without Ben Roethlisberger? I would think that would pique curiosity all the more. The one thing to it is, if you believe everything that we're reporting, that most media outlets in Pittsburgh are reporting, you're not going to see a ton of Kenny Pickett because he's running the third team. And if he's running the third team, he's not going to get out there until like the third or fourth quarter of the first preseason game. And that's kind of tough to sit through and watch. If you're any football fan, you're getting way down the depth chart here. So I'm real interested to see how the numbers break down. If you get this weird spike late in the game of people tuning in because Pickett's in, or will they hold on that long? I don't know. It's going to be interesting to watch how the numbers fluctuate for a Steelers game.
Yeah, I could. You laid out those two scenarios at the top there, and I could see it going either way. I do think in summer with people on vacation and stuff, I think it is always harder probably to pop a number when schedules are a little more in flux than they are once the regular season starts in September.
For sure. And that's why the NFL moved the games when they did, and they never start before Labor Day anymore, because they don't want the first NFL weekend to look weird because people are fluctuating and they're way over Labor Day weekend. Like, colleges don't seem to mind that. They'll take the weekend to themselves before the NFL starts. In fact, that's kind of why they created a week zero, that they call it, where teams like, you know, Florida State's playing Duquesne, you know? You get mega matchups. Like, I can't remember when Notre Dame's playing Ohio State, but you get a mega matchup like that just made for TV because it is the football game that weekend before the NFL starts, which is always the Thursday after Labor Day. Kids are going back to school. And to your point, life just gets more regimented once August ends, right?
Right, right.
So, you know, we'll see that. Another thing I wanted to bring up, and this is sports specific, but at the same time, it has the mainstream appeal of a multimedia conversation, television conversation. That's the passing of Vin Scully, who was one of, if not the most iconic television broadcasters for the sport of baseball in my lifetime. I mean, Vin Scully's voice meant baseball for a long, long time. And, you know, he was how many times chronicled and, if not lampooned, embraced by like The Simpsons, the Naked Gun movies, you know, like Vin Scully's voice was copied and I think mimicked, Rob, more times over than just about any baseball announcer for the world of Hollywood to create a baseball feel. You kind of created Vin Scully, did you not?
Yes. I mean, he became the archetype, right? In a lot of pop culture, he was the archetype. The archetype announcer for baseball or maybe
the sort of sing-songy quality of being like the good baseball qualities of Brockmire, I think were a direct tie to Vin Scully.
Yes.
You know, the excessive drinking and, you know, the carousing. Maybe that was more Myron Cope. Who knows? But, the baseball calling the game aspect, that was Vin Scully, I think, anyway.
I think so, too.
A little more Midwest as opposed to Scully being New York and eventually L.A., but that quality certainly permeated. And the last point about that, and this has gotten a great deal of attention today, is that the Pirates now have a Pirates Hall of Fame. They're one of the few teams that just didn't have their own Hall of Fame. And apparently this goes all the way back to the start of PNC Park opening and the cost overruns that came into play and why they didn't have one initially and why it took so long to get one in place. And it's not like the Pirates to not pay attention to cost overruns. We know that's been their MO with their roster, let alone with their stadium for how many years. One response that I've gotten repeatedly since the first class came out was, why isn't Bob Prince in the first class? And, you know, to that I say, it's baseball. It goes back even way further than the Steelers do. There's 130 years, is beyond a century worth of players here. Right. And they went 19 deep on the first class as it was. So they will get to Bob Prince. I mean, even the Steelers, to my point about Myron, even the Steelers took a long time to get Myron Cope in.
Right.
He just got in.
Right.
He just got in now for the Steelers Hall of Fame. And that thing's at least 5 or 6 years old now.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, it's and especially with the Pirates, it's the first one. Give them time. Give them a chance.
Yeah, and kind of the last broadcaster tie I'll make into that is one guy that I wrote about today that I wish had gone in initially was Dick Grote. And Dick Grote has stayed current with people in Pittsburgh for those who never saw him play because he had been the Pitt basketball broadcaster for so long because people forget he was a great basketball player at Duke somewhat. It's some folks, I mean, diehard sports fans know that sort of thing, but that's how he stayed connected with the Pittsburgh community long after he stopped playing baseball. Was he called Pitt basketball games with Bill Hillgrove forever? You know, it was only a couple years ago where he walked away from the microphone and that's all I knew listening to Pitt basketball was Grote and Hillgrove for how many years screaming at the refs, of course, after every dead ball, but that's neither here nor there. What else we got coming up for TV Q&A and TV talk this week, Rob?
Sure. TV Q&A. We've got an eagle-eyed viewer who spotted someone in a WQED documentary from 2013 who they think is a local TV reporter. Is it? Find out. And then later in the week in TV Talk, I'll have my review of A League of Their Own. Already did the feature story on that, but the review is coming later this week.
So we'll get all the Pittsburgh references and tie-ins and things of that nature then, huh?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that was in the feature story that ran in print Sunday and went online Friday. But whether is it worth watching? That's the question that I'll address in this week's TV Talk column.
All right, we'll have that coming up with Rob. Make sure you check that out and read Breakfast with Benz throughout the course of the week as we continue our coverage of training camp. I'll be back up there within a couple hours after this thing posts. And then I'll be up there for a few days and then back. And like I said, on DVE for the pregame show in advance of Seahawks and Steelers game one of the preseason, all of our coverage at Trib Live. This is Pittsburgh Pop on the Trib Live podcast page.